Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny.
This week, on Halloween, Kate Summerscale tells us a true ghost story in her new book, The Haunting of Alma Fielding.
Kate Summerscale is the author of the number one best-selling The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher, winner of the Samuel Johnson Prize, and was adapted into a major ITV drama. Her first book, the best-selling The Queen of Whale K, won a Somerset Maugham Award and was shortlisted for the Whitbread Biography Award. Her third book, Mrs. Robinson's Disgrace, was a Sunday Times bestseller, while her fourth, The Wicked Boy, was shortlisted for the CWA Gold Dagger for non-fiction in 2017. And Kate was elected a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 2010. And her latest book, which we're going to talk about today, is The Haunting of Alma Fielding, a true ghost story. Kate, welcome to Little Atoms.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Tell us, first of all, where you first came across the story that's in this book.
Yeah, I came across it. I was sort of looking for a haunting to write about. I just had a yen to tackle that subject, and I assumed it would be sort of late Victorian, but in fact the most compelling story I came across was this one, which was in a book published in the 1950s but relating a case that took place in 1938, and the book is now out of print, but it was by the ghost hunter himself, Nandor Fodor, and I became very intrigued by what really went on between him and Alma Fielding, the woman he investigated.
And indeed, the book is called The Haunting of Alma Fielding, but, you know, you could have subtitled it The Suspicions of Mr. Fodor. It's very much the story of Nandor Fodor as well. Let's talk about, first of all, who he was, something of his background, and I guess how he ended up being a paranormal researcher.
He was a Jewish-Hungarian immigrant who came to London via New York. And he was a journalist and had studied law, so he had a law degree. But his real passion was the supernatural. And to his absolute delight, he got a job as a supernatural researcher, a ghost hunter, in London in 1934. And so his hobby became his career, and he was able to devote himself to investigating paranormal phenomena and trying to prove the existence of spirits and uncanny events.
So let's talk about the organisation then, so the International Institute for Psychical Research, which was only one of a number of institutes of psychical research that were in and around London at the time. Tell us something about who they were and what they were doing.
Yeah, it was the newest, the youngest of the psychical research institutes on the scene. And they were, the International Institute, where Fodor worked, was composed unusually both of spiritualists and people of a more scientific bent. So it was an uneasy alliance of people who were convinced that the dead survived and that supernatural events were attempts of the spirits to communicate with the living, and people who were more open-minded about what the uncanny events could signify, and indeed even if they were objectively real or delusional. And so there was a great mixture of attitudes and people in the Institute, and it was rather a precarious venture in that Fodor had to do a lot of fundraising just to keep it going, really. He became a bit of an impresario as well as a scientist, in that he would sort of stage screenings and seances as ways of raising money, while also trying to conduct a very serious empirical project to establish beyond doubt that supernatural forces existed, and to also try to work out where they came from, what created them.
And there's a whole group of fascinating people in and around this institute as well. Some people that have links to Hollywood, for instance, actors. And one woman I particularly wanted you to talk about is known as the Countess. Tell us about her.
Yeah, she's Countess Weidenbruch, who came from Austria with her husband, a portrait painter. And she had known Rilke. She was a very literary figure. Who wrote books, and well, she wrote books, she said, while in trance, so she would write them automatically. She'd compose novels, which she believed were actually written by her ancestors speaking through her. And she was also an artist, and she had had various spiritual experiences and came to Britain basically because she was broke. The financial disasters that hit Europe in the 1920s forced her and her husband just to eke out a living in sort of bedsits in Earl's Court instead of living in the lap of luxury in a sort of Austrian schloss, which is where she'd been brought up. And she was a great friend of Nandor Fodor's, Nandi as she called him, and he and the Countess were sort of collaborators. But her attitudes were much less sceptical than his, and she became quite angry with him for the way in which he treated Alma, to whom the Countess became close in the course of the investigation.
And we'll come on to that in a little while. This particular time, so we're talking, as you said, we start off in about 1934, so we're between the wars. First of all, let's talk about why spiritualism itself is so popular at this particular time. But then again, also the investigation of psychic phenomena, which obviously still goes on now, but is, you know, much less scientifically respectable than it once was. So let's talk about, first of all, again, you know, why was spiritualism so popular at this particular time?
Yeah, spiritualism was sort of founded in the United States in the middle of the 19th century as a religion. And it the basic tenet was that the dead survived. They could communicate with the living, and if you created the right conditions, like seances, that they would appear and speak and even touch people in the seance circle. And it took off in England in the wake of the First World War and the flu pandemic in 1918 because of the enormous number of lives lost and the grief that was abroad in the country then. So I think seance circles became a source of great consolation. They probably acted in part as a sort of group therapy, because the bereaved would gather together and they would talk about and talk to their loved ones that they had lost. And so it became a sort of swept the country and became quite commonplace to sort of go to a seance. Mediums and psychics were written about in the press and clairvoyants. At the same time, there was quite a different sort of intellectual current going on, whereby there were so many technological innovations were becoming commonplace, like the telephone and even the television, but certainly the talking pictures, the radio, gramophone, and people became more sort of open to the idea that these channels of communication might even open up between the living and the dead. And technological and theoretical advances were such that it just seemed kind of plausible that scientists were accelerating towards discoveries that might include a way of opening up the other world, the world of the spirit.
Before we move on to Alma's case, let's just talk briefly about some of the other famous cases that the International Institute for Psychical Research and Fodor himself obviously investigated. One which we've talked about a number of times on this show before, which I absolutely adore, is of course Jeff, the famous talking mongoose.
Yes, and it seems a very good match that Fodor, he went to try to find Jeff, because Fodor himself was a rather high-spirited exuberant and mischievous individual. And Jeff the Talking Mongoose was a great sort of media sensation in the tabloid press in the early 1930s. And Harry Price, who was the most famous ghost hunter in Britain, went out to try to find him and failed. So, of course, Fodor, who was Harry Price's great rival, wanted to do better. And he wrote letters to Jeff before his visit saying, "Dear Jeff, you know, I'm coming to, I can't wait to meet you. I'm going to bring you chocolate." Because Jeff, among other things, is known to be very partial to butter and chocolate. And he was a very rude and outspoken and boastful mongoose who was said to sort of flaunt his ability to speak in many languages and described himself as the fifth dimension. So Fodor went out and stayed in the farmhouse where Jeff was supposed to live, and although he set up various contraptions, sort of automatic cameras to capture his image and so on, he was very disappointed to not either see or hear Jeff in the course of his visit, and he left him quite an angry note about how ungrateful Jeff had been about the chocolates and so on, and his refusal to appear for him. You know, Fodor kind of seemed to veer between being very earnest and intent on finding a ghost, proof of the supernatural, being a very serious researcher. But he also had a great sense of fun and adventure. And a lot of the pleasure he took in ghost hunting, I think, was that it was all a bit of a lark. And he loved the imaginative weirdness of the stuff that he encountered, and the sheer sort of nerve of some of the frauds which he exposed. Because to his disappointment, as often as not, when he went in search of ghosts, he found people dressed up in sheets and the like. So he was becoming increasingly frustrated by 1938, when he'd been ghost hunting for 4 years, and really rather desperate to prove his seriousness and ability as a ghost hunter.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Listed to Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Kate Summerscale. We're talking about her latest book, The Haunting of Alma Fielding, A True Ghost Story. And Kate, so let's introduce Alma. Alma Fielding lives with her family and a lodger in a lower middle class area just outside of Croydon. Tell us who she was.
She was a wife and mother, age 34. She lived with her husband, Les, a builder, her son, Don, who just joined his father as an apprentice, and a lodger called George, to whom she was close. And she and Les had been married for a long while, 17 years or so. And she, in February, one night in February 1938, the two of them were lying in bed when things started to crash against the wall. The glass lifted up, a light bulb, their eiderdown lifted off the bed. And they started sort of screaming for help, and Don and George came to their aid. And this sort of poltergeist activity, as Alma identified it, continued into the next day, continued when she called some reporters from the Sunday Pictorial. They too witnessed weird happenings in her suburban end of terrace house. So she'd been somebody perfectly anonymous and unknown to the public, and suddenly there she was on the front page of the Pictorial as this haunted woman whose house had been violently attacked by a poltergeist.
So, a poltergeist. I knew what a poltergeist was, as opposed to a ghost that walks through the wall in an old house with its head under its arm or something. It's a spirit that, you know, violently throws things around a room. But I always assumed that a poltergeist was, you know, had always been a different type of ghost. So I was sort of surprised to learn from the book that the appearance of poltergeists, or the sort of invention, shall we say, of the idea of the poltergeist, is again something that's very tied to a specific period of time, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if you sort of cast back, you can find poltergeists written about for centuries, you know, the forces that created those particular kinds of effects of banging and throwing and so on. But I was surprised to learn that they were enormously popular in 1930s England. The first time the word was used in the popular press, 1926. And they were identified as a kind of lower class gangster ghost. So that poltergeists were almost spirits of the sort of disreputable, slightly shabby new modern age of aspiration and social mobility. And so instead of them being the seemly ghouls in ancient castles, they were sort of violently vandalizing working class homes. And so it was very interesting to realize the sort of sociological significance of the poltergeist and the fact that it was a sort of force of subversion, of class subversion, and that they were threatening, or they channeled a certain kind of air of threat that was emanating from changes in Britain as a whole.
When does Alma come to Fodor's attention?
Well, he was told about the article in the Sunday Pictorial, so he read it and immediately wrote to the editor of the Pictorial saying, please can I have the address of this family so I can get down there and investigate. And he was given the address, and he went to Croydon and interviewed Alma and her family, and he took some of his colleagues with him, and between them they witnessed some pretty odd events that they found inexplicable by natural, you know, they could have no natural cause. So they were extremely excited. They were sort of made a log of all the things that were going on inside the house. Fodor started to interview Alma, a process which continued over the next few weeks, actually. And yeah, the investigation was launched. Fodor hoped that this would be the case that would make his name, save the Institute from financial ruin, and change the course of psychical science.
Now, I'm keen that we don't give away too much of what happens and how the investigation goes, because this book reads like it's absolutely gripping. It reads like a novel, like a thrilling story. You just want to know what happens next. So I don't want to spoil that for the readers. But perhaps let's talk about how Alma's abilities, to begin with, there's a poltergeist, but then her abilities change and develop as the investigation goes along. So what else happened?
At first the poltergeist seems really quite malevolent and unruly, and seems to be throwing things at Alma and others. But when Fodor and his friends took her to the Institute in South Kensington, The poltergeist sort of became more benign and enchanting and started to produce, or enchant it. It started to produce objects. Alma seemed able to make things materialise from thin air. Small items, pretty things, little glass ornaments and jewels, a perfume bottle, and a key. The investigators were absolutely astonished at how she was doing it, because even when they insisted that she be strip searched before the session and dressed in a sort of a sewn up body stocking, she still seemed able to produce these magical objects. And then she started to show other powers, like she believed that she'd been projected from a cinema in Croydon to the International Institute in South Kensington. But as in her body, she was projected from one place to another and then returned. So she sort of flown across London astrally. And then she seemed to repeat this feat in a couple of other instances. So they were rushing about trying to prove this, to gather evidence. And Fodor and his colleagues interviewed lots of witnesses. And they tried to catch her out as well. They would sort of try to trace her footsteps and see if her stories stood up and whether there were places that she might have bought some of her more astonishing and miraculous productions. So there was a very strange tension there between the desire to believe in her and to think that they had found this most wonderful, gifted woman. But their desire, because they needed it to be sort of solid, they were also sort of her persecutors as well as her champions. And we're running around trying to set traps for her and to check whether people would corroborate her story. So it was a very complicated dance that developed, particularly between her and Fodor, about whether they were on the same side or opposite sides, really.
And you mentioned that the Countess becomes more and more distressed at Fodor's methods. And Fodor, while this is going along, he's starting to develop a theory as to what might be going on here, but what might be going on in these sort of hauntings in general, theories that are drawn from another, at the time, perceived pseudoscience that was developing alongside the investigation of psychic phenomena, and that was psychoanalysis. So what does Fodor think is going on from a sort of psychoanalytic perspective here?
Yeah, the Countess, I mean, part of her growing unease about the investigation was that Fodor was being too sort of persecutory towards Alma and too suspicious and too sort of physically intrusive in his methods. But also, as you say, she really didn't like the theories that he was starting to come up with, first the Freudian theories, which were not just about Alma, but about supernatural activity in general and poltergeists in particular, which was that they might be real supernatural events, but generated not by spirits, but by the repressed unconscious wishes of the individuals around whom they took place. So he started looking for a trauma in Alma's life, something that had happened to her, something in her psyche which she probably had no knowledge of because she'd repressed it, buried it so surely, that was emanating from her in as a poltergeist force. Where the Countess and others in the Institute were confirmed spiritualists, and they liked neither the suggestion that supernatural activity might have nothing to do with the spirits of the dead, but also the sexual overtones to many of these Freudian ideas, which suggested that there might be some sexual component as well as a strand of anger and fury in the supernatural forces emanating from people. So they were sort of base forces rather than elevated heavenly forces.
Well, as I said, I don't want to go into where the investigation eventually ends up. So just to finish off, the book also, while this story is going on, obviously features details of the political and world historical backdrop that's going on. As you've already mentioned, that spiritualism itself became super popular after the First World War, but the events of this book are leading up to the beginnings of the Second World War, and you sort of detail the changes that are going across the continent. Obviously, as you know, you've already mentioned that Nándor Fodor was a Hungarian Jew, but obviously the events of this story are taking place in London, a city that's, you know, soon to be on the end of serious bombing as well. Tell us something about the sort of background against which this story takes place.
When I started investigating this particular case in February 1938, I was amazed to realise that there were lots of poltergeist cases around. There'd been one in Bethnal Green in the papers just a couple of weeks before this Croydon case. There was another in Stornoway in the Outer Hebrides. And Alma's case, the Croydon poltergeist, shared a front page of the Sunday Pictorial with a big picture of a cutout of Adolf Hitler shouting as he delivered a speech to his people. And the papers were not only full of poltergeist, but full of the threat of war. And it was as if the country already, this long before war actually broke out, as we now know, was braced for conflict. And it seemed, I realised increasingly as I read more around the history of the time and the papers, that it was a very, very jittery era. And of course, people could still remember the First World War. Many people, including Alma's husband Lev, had served in that war and had been injured in it and had suffered various mental injuries too. Lev still woke up with trench dreams. And here they were confronting the threat, the almost certain threat, of another war. And it struck me that poltergeists were awfully close to the blitz that was going to come to London soon, and for which, again, people were bracing themselves for aerial bombardment and preparing the country for that eventuality. And I thought that maybe some of the outbreak of these particular kinds of violent, jumpy, rackety working class ghosts might well have been a kind of expression of anxiety, as well as being a sort of distraction and entertainment in the Sunday papers. They also said something about the state of mind or state of soul that was zeitgeist in Britain at the time, and particularly in London perhaps, which was felt itself as the sort of bullseye, has become the bullseye of the German bombardment. And so I started to wonder about ghosts as expressions of cultural, social anxiety, as well as of individual and personal anger or grief.
So I've been talking to Kate Summerscale. We've been talking about her new book, The Haunting of Alma Fielding, A True Ghost Story, which is out now from Bloomsbury. Kate, thank you so much for taking the time to share it with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by me, Neil Denny, edited by Sky Redman, and was first broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM. Little Atoms is supported by 89UP and hosted by Acast. If you enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, rate us on iTunes, and even tell a friend. Thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.